Please silence all electronic devices.
Mr. Speaker!
I have said this since the end of June. I'm surprised that the entire budget was held up over one policy issue.
Lord, strike me down if I vote for this bill.
You are making a mockery of this process. You are deceiving all of North Carolina. Your leadership is an embarrassment to the history of this great state.
Any further discussion or debate?
From downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks, as always, for clicking play. Today, a conversation about impeachment proceedings, both past and present. We visit with a former North Carolina Attorney General, Secretary of State, and a U.S. Senate staffer during the Watergate hearings. Rufus Edmiston is your guest. We spoke Tuesday morning at his law office in downtown Raleigh. Edmiston was a staffer for Senator Sam Ervin during the Watergate hearings in July 1973, when, during closed-door testimony, it was revealed that President Richard Nixon had a phone recording system set up in the White House. Alexander Butterfield, the deputy attorney to President Nixon, testified about that system, and the attorney questioning Butterfield that day was Gene Boyce, prominent attorney from North Carolina. This phone recording system was previously unknown to Congress and the American people. And this is where my conversation with Rufus Edmiston begins.
Now, that was a total secret. Nobody knew that. Total secret. And when that was revealed to Senator Ervin, I remember he was just, his eyebrows started bouncing up and down more so than they did otherwise in the hearings, if any of the listeners are old enough to remember. When Senator Ervin got excited, his eyebrows would be like windshield wipers bouncing up and down. And I remember he said, "Now don't tell anybody, don't tell anybody." Well, we kept that a secret. And then when it was disclosed the next day in the hearings, the public hearings, the nation was astounded because there was the smoking gun. And, of course, the senator then decided that he would ask Nixon to turn the tapes over. We were up in Senator Ervin's room, his own private office, and the senators were all lined up, and the discussion started happening about, well, shouldn't we give the president a chance to voluntarily turn them over? The senator said, "Well, Rufus, go in there and call up the White House and tell the president that I would love to talk with him." Well, he sort of said that like go get a loaf of bread. That was a pretty big, tall order. So I went into the ante room off the senator's private quarters, and I called up the White House and got Rosemary Wood, the president's secretary, of the famed 18-minute gap lady. And I said, "Ms. Wood, Senator Ervin would like to speak with the president." She said, "Well, hold on, I'll get back with you." Well, you got to remember that all during that time, President Nixon had been saying that, "Well, the committee's out to get me, the committee's out to get me." Well, unknown to me, the president came on the line first and said, "Hello, Senator Ervin, this is Richard Nixon." I was dumbfounded. I was just totally dumbfounded. And I said, "Mr. President, Senator Ervin wants to get you, sir, on the phone." Oh, did I make a boo-boo that wouldn't quit, but in hindsight, it was the funniest thing that ever happened. And then Senator Ervin began his conversation with Richard Nixon, and we could not hear. We could only see the expression on Senator Ervin's face and know the words that he was using. And it was very, very plain that things were not going well. And so, in the end, the President Nixon said, "No, the tapes are not available. I will not turn them over." And then the committee had a big discussion that was very fruitful and decided to subpoena the president. That was the first time in history that a committee of the Congress had ever subpoenaed a president in the history of the country. And I knew that somebody had to carry that subpoena down there, so I chose myself.
So let me pause for a second and just note and jump in if my historical context is inaccurate. The vote from the Senate committee to decide to subpoena the president was a unanimous vote.
It was a unanimous vote.
So that is
very significant. And it shows one difference right there between now and then, that they weren't as divided and polarized and stratified. It was no kind of rancor like today whatsoever.
You nominated yourself to bring this subpoena down to the White House.
Take me into that moment if you can. I mean, is your heart racing? I know you were sweating because it was an extremely hot day in Washington. I've read that. But tell me a little bit about the moment. Is your heart racing? Are you nervous? Are you excited? What's going on?
As you just mentioned, Jeff, it was one of the hottest days I can ever remember, even hotter than the North Carolina balmy days in July. And it was July then, July the 23rd, 1973, and I emerged from the Senate office building and got in the back of a police car. And my mother said, well, that's one of the times you were in the back of a police car for a good reason. I knew that this was big time stuff, but there was so much happening all the time that there was some revelation every single day in Watergate that some things were just, it was almost like routine, but not this day. For some reason, I knew that this was a pivotal day. And as the police car crept slowly down Pennsylvania Avenue, there were hordes of news people following us. And it was no blue lights or any kind of siren or anything like that. But it's almost like the waters parted for us to get down there. And I came up, the police car drove up with a preordained meeting. We had called down there and told the president's legal counsel that they would be coming with a subpoena. I remember walking into the executive office building and my heart was pounding because I thought, you know, don't mess this thing up. Be professional. Don't kid around. But I had a little impish scheme up my sleeve anyway. I got there and the president's lawyer, Mr. Fred Buzhardt, was waiting with another gentleman. And I read the subpoena. I didn't read the whole thing. I read it according to Senate resolution so-and-so. I hereby subpoena you on behalf of the committee. And I said, by the way, while we're at it, let me give you this copy of the Constitution. Now, that was a smart-alecky thing for a little 32-year-old. Well, I was only 31 at that time.
You had a pocket Constitution.
I had a pocket Constitution in my back pocket. They didn't get mad about it. They sort of chuckled and said,
that's
a pretty good trick there on your part. And then I came back out, and there was just a horde of news people waiting there. What'd they say? Was the president there? No, the president wasn't there. But I did ask him. I said, Mr. Buzhardt, the president wouldn't be around anywhere, would he? He said, no, he was just here a few minutes ago. You missed him by about 10 minutes. And I said, well, I don't imagine he would have taken it from me anyway. And he said, probably not. So that was my little footnote in history. In fact, Time Magazine one time did a story, and they said that I was a footnote in history, and they put it in a footnote.
It was a footnote, yes, but was it the high point in your professional life?
It really was the high point, and it was mainly ministerial. Anybody could have taken it down there, but there were so many different ways to mess up or do something wrong.
Rufus Edmiston here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. He was the deputy chief counsel to the Senate Watergate Committee back in the summer of 1973. Let's bring it to present day where there is again an impeachment inquiry going on. And it is important to note that President Nixon was not impeached. He was not removed from office by the act of Congress or an act of Congress. He left because there was pressure from the Republican Party. They saw the writing on the wall, which were Democratic majorities in both chambers, the House and the Senate, and he would have been impeached, he would have been removed if it had come to that, but it didn't. Today, the landscape is a little bit different. As you mentioned a little earlier in our conversation, the level of discord, much greater, but there's also a divided Congress. I'm wondering what commonalities you do see between the summers of 73 into 74, and then what's taking place today with this impeachment and this impeachment inquiry.
In the case of the Senate Watergate Committee, you had one committee that was formed totally to handle this, and Senator Mansfield, who was the majority leader at that time, made sure that nothing competed with the Watergate Committee. And right now in the House side, you've had several committees working on it, and on the House side during Nixon, you had the Judiciary Committee doing all the work, and now you have the Senate Intelligence Committee doing the work there. So there are a lot of commonality, and there are a lot of differences, too. As I mentioned earlier, there was nowhere near the rancor. In fact, you've stated it right, Jeff, a moment ago, when Senator Hugh Scott and Senator Goldwater came down from Capitol Hill and told the president that if impeachment occurred, he would be impeached. And if he were impeached, he would be convicted. And some of them said that we will vote to impeach you. So the president did not face impeachment, although they're holding impeachment hearings, which are very similar today, except they're being held by the Intelligence Committee. In Watergate, the Congress was controlled in the House and Senate by the Democrats, and the Senate is now controlled by the Republicans. And there seems to be no bending and nobody deviating from the party line. And we'll notice in the House impeachment hearings that not one single Republican has said anything different than finding some excuse to attack the accusers.
It's noteworthy when you juxtapose it to today, because back during the Watergate hearings, you had Senator Howard Baker, who was a Republican from Tennessee, the minority leader, I believe, of the party, and you had Sam Ervin, who was leading this effort. He was a Democrat, of course, from North Carolina, and you don't have that today. You don't have any of that kind of bipartisanship. I would just simply note that. Before we move on, I want to ask you about Senator Ervin. But before we do that, just briefly, how closely are you watching, and what do you expect the outcome to be with this impeachment inquiry into President Trump?
Well, I expect there to be impeachment articles, because the Democrats are leading the way in putting together a cohesive, comprehensive story. It's coming in like a story right now. But I would warn them, if they only do the phase where the president was talking to the president of Ukraine, they need to add some more obstruction of justice and abuse of power, because I think that the American public can understand abuse of power more than they can some of the other things. But I fully expect there to be impeachment articles. I expect them to go to the Senate, and unless things change, it could be that not one senator out of the whole crowd would vote for impeachment. As it stands right now, unless the polls change, I don't think it will change, and I think there will be an impeachment. There will be a trial in the Senate, which will take a lot of time and cause a lot of dismay in the country. And we'll come to no end, and President Trump will say, well, you indicted me, but you didn't convict me, so that means I'm innocent. So that's sort of how I expect this thing to turn out.
I don't think you can write a political, or at least a good political history book about North Carolina without mention, at the very least, of Ervin. He was a giant in the political history of this state. How did you get connected with him all those years ago?
Well, as I said in my book, That's Rufus, I was very interested in politics from an early age in the mountains of North Carolina. And this man named Senator Ervin would come to Boone sometimes, and I thought, man, he's really something. And he would give these fiery oratories, and he was just a champion to me. And I kept aggravating the man. I'd say, well, someday I want to work for you, Senator Ervin. So I graduated Carolina and headed to Washington without a job, and ended up teaching the third grade for the first year. And finally, there was an opening on the Senator's Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights, and I took that position, went to law school at nighttime, and then the senator asked me to drive him around over the state, and that's where I got to really know the senator, because day after day we'd go along that old Chrysler automobile. I call it the Ship of Fools, sort of like that Willa Cather novel, The Ship of Fools. It's swaying back and forth, and we spent night after night in old hotels.
What color was the Oldsmobile?
The old Chrysler.
I'm sorry.
The old Chrysler was a dark blue, and I remember it was a big old hunk of a car, and I drove that thing, driving the senator all over the country. If it was somewhere way out of state, he would fly, but most of the time I was driving him, and still in law school most of the time. So I was dedicated, and then when Watergate came along, I think the senator wanted somebody that knew that knew the inner workings of Capitol Hill. And it was just such a pleasure. I say that I'm the luckiest guy in the world to get to have been around Senator Ervin all those years. Ate with him, slept with him. We used to have our little bourbon and ginger ale every night. We'd have a little, he'd say to me, "You got the ginger ale?" And I said, "Yes, Senator, I got the ginger ale." He loved Old Fitz. I'm not telling stories on him that anybody doesn't know that was around him. And we would have our little nip every night and calm down a little bit, head back out on the road the next day campaigning or going somewhere. And it was still a genteel time of campaigning back then. In 1968 was the last time he ran for public office. And I tell this little story one time about that we were in Chatham County, and somehow his secretary had failed to get us a hotel room. And so I said, "Well, Senator, there's an old hotel." He said, "Yeah, there's one over there in Pittsburgh named the Blair Hotel." And he said, "Well, let's go over there." And I went over there, drove him over there, and we came into the hotel, and the old clerk, who had glasses down his nose about 4 inches, said, "There's not but one room up there, boys, only one room with one bed in it. Now, what you going to do?" Now, oh, my Lord, I've slept in the same room with Senator Ervin dozens and dozens of times, but never in the same bed. And I thought, "Oh, my God, what shall I do?" And, you know, back in Senator Ervin's day, you just pile people in the bed, no matter how many there were. And I was accustomed to it, too. When I grew up in the mountains, we had five boys in one huge room with three beds in it. So you always slept with somebody. And so I decided, well, I'm sure going to go through this. And Senator had a real bad habit of snoring a lot anyway, and that was bad enough. But I got in the bed and put about half of my body on the bed and about half on the floor, all parked up on one elbow on the bed. And we get into the night a little bit, and all of a sudden the senator rolls over and touches me, and I said, "Oh, my God, I'm touching God. Oh, Lord, I'm touching God." I thought, how am I going to get, I can't go through the night this way. And finally, two or three more times after that occurred, I got up and found an old blanket in the little tiny closet in that poor, decrepit Blair Hotel, and went into the bathroom and put it in the bathtub, the old claw-footed bathtub, because there wasn't enough room to lay down totally in the floor. But I got in the bathtub and slept 3 or 4 hours in there, and I call that my night of sleeping with God. And that's just one of the many stories that I have of traveling with Senator Ervin, who was just such a marvelous man. And he didn't change from one day to the next. I never picked up a bag for him. I never carried his bags. He wouldn't allow it.
Tell me a little bit more about the Blue Chrysler. Are you smoking cigarettes? Are you smoking pipes? Are you listening to 8-tracks? This is before the days of cell phones, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. No cell phones, no nothing. We're going along in this big old blue Chrysler.
Bench seat, obviously.
Absolutely. It was a huge machine, I know that. Bought in Morganton, brand new. The senator wasn't much for radio, and he couldn't sleep in a car. He never slept in a car, so we were chugging down the road, and guess what? Here I'm a young law student. Here was the guy that I could ask all the questions of, all the great cases of the day. And I never remember a time when I would bring up a case that the senator did not know it, and even about know how many pages it ran in the opinions. And I learned more driving down the road with Senator Ervin about law than I did my entire 3.5 years in law school.
1974, Richard Nixon resigns. And shortly thereafter, you run for Attorney General of North Carolina. You're the Attorney General in North Carolina for a decade, Democratic Attorney General. And then in 1984, you attempted to make the leap that many people have tried to make, which is to go from Attorney General to Governor of North Carolina. I want to talk about the 1984 election and a little bit of just context to set it up. You won the primary, but you did so with only about 30% of the vote. So you were not able to avoid a runoff or a second primary. You went to the second primary, and you won there. You were victorious. However, it was a year that was very good for Republicans. And Ronald Reagan won re-election. Jesse Helms defeated then-term limited Jim Hunt in a U.S. Senate race. And you lost in the general election to Jim Martin. I've read that you hated the campaign trail and that you hated that part of 1984. Did you really hate it?
I didn't like campaigning for governor because it was always gotcha. We were just getting into the stage of gotcha politics. I always loved running for attorney general. I loved being attorney general. But the running for governor was so different because so much is at stake. Appointments, policies. It got, for one solid year, I don't remember spending any time. I never had a day off for a year. Not one day off. Not a sick day. I don't care if I was feeling like hell. I still was out on the campaign trail. And part of my loss, too, was the overwhelming victory of Ronald Reagan, who took the state but over 60%. My goodness. If governor for life Jim Hunt couldn't win, then my goodness, I couldn't win. But there was so much bitterness in my campaign. There were so many of us running at one time. In the beginning of the campaign, there were five of us who had over 60% name recognition. Lieutenant Governor Jimmy Green, Eddie Knox, just any number of people, Locke Faircloth. And every time that I would defeat somebody, it seemed like another battalion would come up over the hillside ready to knock me down again. So I was pretty well beaten up in the second primary, which I eked out. And I spent a lot of my time trying to achieve the votes of the people that I beat in the primary. And I was in Charlotte one time after I'd gotten the nomination, and lo and behold, here I see the plane land of the president. People start walking off the plane. And all of a sudden, one of them is Eddie Knox, the guy that I was running against in the primary.
Let me just pause you for a second. Is this primary? Is this prior to the second primary?
No, this is after. Okay. This is after I'd beaten Mr. Knox in the runoff primary. And he's coming off of a plane with Jesse Helms and the president, which of course meant that he was endorsing Ronald Reagan and endorsing Jesse Helms and coming out for my opponent, Jim Martin, who, by the way, was one of the finest people I ever knew in my political life. I also covered that in the book, that I couldn't have worked with a better person, because after I was defeated for governor, I stayed and practiced law for 4 years and then ran for attorney general and served with Jim Martin. So it's pretty unique that you serve with a guy who beat you but have a very good rapport with him. And so I like that. But 84 was a mess because I felt like I was never getting anywhere, because I was trying to win the votes of the people that I'd beaten in the primary. So it was not, I don't count that as fun, I really don't. But I made hundreds and hundreds of friends. It was so long ago that I don't choose to remember most of it.
Rufus Edmiston here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. He is the scribe behind That's Rufus, a memoir about his life and the public life from Watergate to Raleigh. And we're talking about his run in 1984. He received the Democratic gubernatorial nomination, but did lose in that general election to Jim Martin. I want to ask you about a dark moment from, I believe it was 1984. There was a plane crash and your campaign manager, Charlie Smith, was killed in a plane crash. Tell me about Charlie Smith.
Charlie Smith was my chief of staff when I was attorney general and a great political analyst and a disciple of Burt Bennett, the Burt Bennett machine in North Carolina. And he was fantastic on the campaign trail and was my manager. And when he died, I seemed to have just lost it. I never could get the mojo back because Charlie's loss was so tremendous. I know that impacted my campaign tremendously. I don't know whether if Charlie had lived that I would have made it anyway because of the popularity of Ronald Reagan, but it was a tremendous loss. And he was out on the campaign trail for me at a fundraiser. I was in Charlotte, And I got this call. You know, there were no such thing as cell phones at that time, that there had been a plane crash. One of the SBI agents who was driving me that night in my Charlotte adventure said, there's been a plane crash in Asheville and some of your people are hurt. So I commandeered an SBI car and an agent with all due speed drove me from Charlotte to Asheville, and I remember being in the Hendersonville hospital, and a doctor came out, and I said, how's Charlie doing? Because he was the only one that was hurt, apparently. He was in the back of the plane, and when it crashed, it fell down backwards on the tail, and he was in the back crushed. And the doctor said, very matter-of-factly, well, he died, and walked off. And I've never forgotten that as long as I lived. Have lived, that how crass this doctor was in telling me, and not even stopping to say I'm sorry. He just said he died and he walked off. And I was crushed for probably a month. I just didn't get it together. And that was right after the first primary. And so I went into the second primary without the benefit of having Charlie Smith as my campaign aide, and it was a sad time for me. That's one of the reasons why I've said in the book that I didn't enjoy running for governor, because I lost my closest political ally and a great friend, Charlie Smith.
You gave up drinking for a period of time. You didn't drink. You mentioned the bourbon and ginger ale earlier in our conversation, but you didn't drink whiskey for about a year. Was that because of this tragedy? Was that trying to control the nerve, so to speak?
No, I said I could not afford during that whole time to ever have a headache or a hangover. And I said, I'm not going to take a drink for the entire time I'm running for governor. And because I said, first of all, I don't have time for it. And secondly, I cannot afford to feel bad the next day. Now, I don't recommend running for governor to stop a drinking problem to people. I never considered myself to have a drinking problem, but I know that was pretty unusual on my part to have been a social drinker to not take a drink for a year. But I just didn't want anything like whiskey to interfere with my performance.
If 1973 was the high of your professional life, is it fair to say that 1984 was the low?
It was the low of my political life, yes. There's no question about it.
I want to ask you quickly about two more things, and then we'll get you out of here. Gardening and 2020 presidential politics. What do you most enjoy gardening? Is it vegetables? Is it flowers? Is it something else?
Well, gardening gives me a peace of mind. You can have the whole world mad at you. You're mad at the whole world, and get out there and put some soil on your hands, dig a hole, plant a tree. It is my reality check, the garden. And I always love working with my mother in the flower garden, because if I could convince her to let me work with her in her flower garden, she was a church lady, then I could get out of going down into the bottom land where we had to do hard work, where my older brothers would have to go. And so I would con my mother into getting her to ask me to help her in the flower garden, and I had a lot more leeway than those boys did down there chopping the weeds out of those corn patches and tobacco patches.
We are less than a year away from the election, which is going to just be fascinating here in North Carolina, from president to Senate, all 170 General Assembly seats, all the U.S. House seats, of course, will be on the ballot. Three of the seven justices in the North Carolina Supreme Court are going to be on the ballot next year. There's so much. It remains to be seen if we get any proposed constitutional amendments. Seems plausible from my vantage point, somebody who spends time in the building. You, as a Democrat, obviously would like to see President Trump defeated. Who do you think has the best path to doing that?
I have looked over all the candidates, and I think we have a fine bunch of candidates, but I have come to the firm conclusion, and did early on, that Vice President Joe Biden has the best chance of winning and helping the ticket in North Carolina. I knew him when he first came to the Senate, and I was with Senator Ervin in 1964. That's how long I've known the man. He's a scrapper. I grow weary of people criticizing him because he has had the audacity to try to work with the other side. I mean, that to me is just crazy when you it gets so bad that you condemn somebody because they would lean over and try to be bipartisan and work for the other work with the other side. I think he is the only person that can help the ticket in North Carolina. I think he would help the governor's race very much. I think he would help to maybe take over the General Assembly. And I think he is still the only one with the moderation and the scrappiness to defeat President Trump. And I believe that he will get the nomination.
Rufus Edmiston was the North Carolina Attorney General from 1974 to 1984, Secretary of State from 1989 until 1996, and way back in 1973, he was a staffer for U.S. Senator Sam Ervin. He was Deputy Chief Counsel on the Senate Watergate Committee. Attorney General Edmiston, thank you for the conversation. I enjoyed it.
Jeff, I enjoyed it too. I've rambled on, but we got it said.
If you are not yet subscribing to the WUNC Politics Podcast, do me a favor and consider doing just that. iTunes, Google Play, and or Stitcher. We'll release our longer form conversations generally Tuesday or Wednesday each week, and then on Fridays, it is a review of some of what took place in North Carolina politics. Becky Gray from the Conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch are your usual guests. Any which way, stay up to date on what is happening with your local government at our website throughout the week, wunc.org. For Rufus Edmiston, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.